This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate, WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, filibuster reform. It may sound dry, but it's really shaking up Washington. Just ask Stephen Colbert.
Harry Reid is trying to stop Republicans from blocking certain legislation. For instance, any legislation.
Plus, the internet group Anonymous takes on cyberbullies and wins. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, the YouTube Supercut, a new art form, or do some people just have too much time on their hands? Or maybe both. Then Snapchat, a new smartphone app that claims to make the pictures you send self-destruct. If only Anthony Weiner had known about that. And then finally, we'll discuss Liz and Dick, a TV movie starring Lindsay Lohan as Elizabeth Taylor.
You know I can't turn my back on my responsibilities.
That's why I'm removing myself.
We'll start with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. On this week's program, we'll discuss filibuster reform. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is pushing for it. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is against it. Who is going to win? And then the internet group Anonymous takes on cyberbullies. Joining me today are Emily Bazelon, Slate Senior Editor. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And from Boston, Massachusetts, Slate Chief Political Correspondent John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And I understand, John, that you are sitting in a dark hotel room without power. Is that right?
I am. I left this symposium and came and all the lights were on, and then suddenly I was in the dark, which, as the listeners know, is my permanent condition anyway.
Well, we will hope that the power on your cell phone holds out long enough for you to bless us with some insights. The filibuster has fallen a long way since the romance of Mr. Smith goes to Washington, once seen by the public, at least, as the tool of a single brave and extremely long-winded legislator. The filibuster has become the standard gumming up mechanism of the Senate. Senators now filibuster, or rather threaten to filibuster, just about everything controversial, ensuring that a minority of 40 senators can block almost anything they want to block. Filibusters have become notional rather than real. No one has to stand up on the floor and talk to delay a vote, the way Jimmy Stewart had to in that movie. And now comes Democratic Senate leader Harry Reid. He's spurred on by some younger colleagues, and he is proposing to finagle Senate rules to reform the filibuster. And this has driven Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell into a paroxysm.
In the name of efficiency, they would prevent the very possibility of compromise and threaten to make the disputes of the past few years look like mere pillow fights.
So, John, what is it that the Democrats contemplate doing to the filibuster? What kind of rules are they going to change? Is there going to be now a just majority rule in the Senate if this goes through?
Well, no. I mean, it's a little more limited than that. So filibusters would be prohibited on what's called the motion to proceed. Motion, basically the motion to take up the legislation, which is kind of, on one hand, it's incredibly frustrating because they don't even get to the merits of the legislation. They just debate whether they can even get to the merits of debating the legislation, which seems crazy. So they would remove the ability to filibuster that. They would remove the ability to filibuster nominations. There would still be ability to filibuster the final vote on a nomination, but not sort of putting the nomination into play. And then I think conference legislation also. In other words, the vote that sends a piece of legislation from the Senate
right.
to go be worked out with the House and for final passage.
John, also, aren't they also going to say if you are going to filibuster the actual bill, you actually have to filibuster it. You actually have to stand there and talk. You can't just say you're going to.
Yes, I was going to get to that. One of the plans is basically any bill that gets between 51 and 60 votes, you can continue to filibuster it. It won't pass, but you have to keep talking. And that's right. So you would return the filibuster to its old rule, which meant you'd have to actually speak on the floor. And I think they'd allow tag teaming. So in other words, you could have one person wouldn't have to do it.
But they're exacting some costs. It's not totally for free. And the idea is to have less of it and, to tax
no
it, basically.
Pain-free. But back to what I was saying about the other is when the reason Republicans and Democrats made this case when they were in the minority want to be able to filibuster the motion to proceed is the motion to proceed basically sets the terms of debate for the underlying measure. And that's something that Republicans say, if you can't filibuster that, then you're always going to be in the disadvantage when you have the public debate.
And let's just quickly talk about the weirdest fact about this proposal, is that apparently it can only be done on the first day of the term. Why is it that it can only happen at this one particular moment when the shaft of light strikes the tomb and the secret door opens?
I think the idea behind this has to do with when you reopen the Senate, you can change the rules. And so you could make a new rule that 51 votes in the Senate is enough to make all the rules. Whereas once the Senate opens again with its old 60 or even 67 votes is what you need to change the rules, it's kind of over.
Right. And the rules are not, don't have the force of law. The rules are things that the Senate makes for itself and it can change them at any time. But after the rules go into effect, it says 67.
Right.
But the theory is that at the very beginning of a term, it's just a majority rule.
Right, exactly. But that's right. Scary to the minority or anyone who imagines being in the minority, because it suggests we could have major upheaval-like rule changes again at these particular moments. On the other hand, I know why the senators don't like this idea, but for the rest of us normal people, why should we be afraid of this? It's not as if the Senate is a well-functioning, well-oiled machine. Who cares if they suddenly make it easier to have lots of rule changes? Maybe we'd be better off experimenting with different kinds of Senates and not having it seem like it's so cemented in its crazy intricacies.
Right. Well, I guess it gets to the questions, is the Senate clogged because of partisanship? Or is the Senate clogged because stupid rules make it clogged? Or is the Senate clogged because it's supposed to be clogged?
I don't think it's supposed to be this clogged, right? I mean, it can't supposed to be this clogged because there's nothing in the Constitution about the filibuster, and it's really a 20th century creation, and it didn't become used to the extent it is now until, I mean, certainly, you know, there's the sort of 1960s beginnings of this, and then it's really like the product of the last 10 years. So it just seems crazy to me that you would really defend all of these rules as some natural Senate right.
John,
it's a combination. It's clogged because these rules have come into greater use, but in part these rules have come into greater use because partisans have basically gimmicked up the operations of the Senate. And, you know, when the filibuster was first used, it was within the boundaries because it was used so rarely. But now it's like having prescription drugs in your medicine cabinet, and you take it when, you know, the pain is acute. But then, like, a year later, you find yourself taking it when, you know, it's just a cloudy day.
And then you have a problem. You're an addict, and you have to go into withdrawal or into rehab. We help you. We don't just, like, leave you out there to take your pain meds forever.
Right. The number of cloture motions has gone up 60-fold in a generation, from basically, you know, a few to more than 100.
And the cloture motion is the sign of the threat.
Right, it's not a filibuster. It's a sign of the threat of a filibuster. Emily, isn't this just pure hypocrisy, though, on the part of the Democrats? The Democrats, faced with a similar motion in 2005,
yes,
fought it.
It is. Whoever is in the minority is going to be clinging to the filibuster because it's your only shred of hope of having power. And so one of the clever things Mitch McConnell did this week was to go and find on record Harry Reid's statements, everybody's statements about how honorable and venerable the filibuster is and how they would never part with it. But I don't think that really matters to the rest of the country either. It seems like some party in the majority is at some point going to blow this thing up. And what I'm interested in is what all the unforeseeable consequences are going to be, because surely we don't really know how it's going to play out. It's like a toothpaste tube, and there's going to be some partisanship that squeezes out somewhere else, and we'll just have to see if getting rid of this for some amount of time makes it easier to pass legislation. Maybe it won't.
Well,
do you mean a toothpaste tube, or do you mean a bump in the rug?
I was thinking of the toothpaste tube analogy.
But toothpaste only comes out one part of the tube.
No, but I mean... Oh, I see.
And you can't get it back in. But the bump in the rug is you push it down one place and it comes up somewhere else.
Maybe you're right. Maybe it's the bump in the rug. I really have trouble with visual metaphors.
It does seem to me that the only thing, the place where this would really apply is on nominations. That if nominations can't be filibustered, then that makes a significant difference. But for major legislation,
you can still filibuster the vote. It's just the initial nomination you can't filibuster. So it's not like all of a sudden 50 votes is going to get you a Supreme Court justice.
But I guess that what's going to happen, on a Supreme 51. Court justice, you might still filibuster. But on the sort of routine nominations, no one's going to bother. Right, that would be a good change. No one's going to bother to filibuster the Assistant Secretary of Commerce.
Right, or the district court appointee from Arizona, which is happening routinely now. And that seems to me it's bad for both parties. I guess what I also think is, how much do you believe that the party in mostly power should get its laws passed? I mean, that one of the arguments for keeping the filibuster is that we are going to kind of career back and forth wildly between one party in power trying their programs and then the other, and we won't have the kind of gridlock that prevents that today. But maybe we want to try different solutions to things and give them a chance to actually operate the way they do in parliamentary systems.
Also, with a House that is controlled by the opposite party, it doesn't even matter. Even if there was pure majority rule in the Senate, controversial legislation would not pass because the Senate needs the House to approve it. So if the House is still controlled by Republicans, it's sort of moot,
right,
at least for this term.
We already have a lot of divided government. Yeah.
I guess what one question I had about this to you, John, is the Republicans are certainly dropping dark hints that if this goes through, they have a lot of tools to grind the Senate still slower. They can throw up other obstacles to make the Senate work inefficiently. My question is, would anyone notice if the filibuster reform got through, but then the minority party used other tools of the Senate, secret holds, whatever it is, to make life slow and make legislation onerous. Is the American public going to be outraged if the Republicans did that?
I think Republicans might try, but I think people might get sick of it after a while. And their ratings are so low, you know, Congress and congressional Republicans, that I think a sustained child's play would be politically not good.
One interesting argument I heard about this potential reform is that a good effect would be that it would cause the opposing party to filibuster only bills it was actually willing to stand up and defend. Because if you're forced to actually do the filibuster, you have to stand up in
public
and make a case against a bill that exists. That allows legislation to be debated out and fought out more on the merits. Whereas the current situation, when you can filibuster a motion to proceed or filibuster sort of even prevent debate from occurring, you can almost secretly block something because the public never tunes in to the merits of the debate. And one example I saw quoted was the Dodd-Frank. The Dodd-Frank was a bill that Republicans were not really willing to oppose publicly, but they were happy to try to oppose it privately, and that a filibuster reform at least force debate about legislation to be much more in the open, or about controversial legislation to be more in the open.
Yeah, it's harder to be sneaky in your opposition, and that seems like it should be a good thing because it's surfacing all these debates and providing for more transparency. And we're journalists, so of course we're in favor of transparency.
So two questions for you guys. One, do you think this will pass, the reform will pass? And two, if it does pass, will the new regime become the standard regime, or will we immediately at some point or it's retreat back to the old way?
I can't believe I'm saying this. I kind of think it's going to pass. I've never thought the filibuster reform had any prayer. It's always seemed to me like something we trot out as a necessary measure that is never going to go anywhere. But I can't see why Reid would be making such a big and public deal with it if he doesn't follow through, because he has the power to follow through. So why would he back down now? It sort of doesn't make sense to me otherwise.
John, do you have a view?
Yeah, I think it probably passes, and I think it doesn't. I think if Republicans were to get into control, they won't change it back, because of course they'll be in control and they'll benefit from this.
Right, and then we'll see where the bump in the rug moves.
It's funny, to your point, Emily. A few years ago, I met the wife of Tom. It's Tom Udall who's pushing this, right?
Yeah.
But I met his wife at a party. And she was talking about how he had just been elected, and this was a big cause of his.
And I remember that, I remember thinking, whatever.
Well, good luck with that.
And yet, here
last
he
laugh.
Is. He's
last
our
laugh,
hero.
Senator.
Go Tom Udall.
Coming up, cyberbullies feel the wrath of the internet's self-appointed sheriff. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Last week, a teenager named Kylie sent out a tweet about her suicidal thoughts. This prompted other teenagers in her social circle to respond viciously, urging her to kill herself, essentially. And at this point, anonymous internet vigilantes in two different groups, Anonymous and Russell League. I don't know Russell League.
It's hard for me to tell exactly what that is, but yes.
jumped in, and these vigilantes identified the bullies and started vexing them, harassing them, and generally making their lives miserable in ways that Emily's going to tell us about for what they'd done to Kylie, and forced them to apologize. So, Emily, what is it that Anonymous and Russell League did, and is this awesome hacktivism or terrifying vigilante justice?
I'm kind of on their side right now. Some members of Anonymous and Russell League have done is essentially unmask these bullies on, mostly it was on Twitter, actually. And this wasn't very hard to do because the kids weren't really hiding their identities. They didn't think anyone was paying attention. So they were saying these incredibly cruel things, telling Kylie to drink bleach and other just vile tweets. And they were using fake handles, but it was very easy to figure out what their real names were. So what these members of Anonymous did was to first say to the kids, if you don't apologize, we're going to out you. The word for this is doxing, like getting all your documentation together. I just realized that's where doxing comes from. It's like your documents. And then we're going to put them all online, and we're going to, you know, tell people what school you go to and tell the principal of your school what you're doing. And so once the kids realized that this was for real, they got nervous and they started apologizing, begging essentially to be left alone. And, you know, usually I am so opposed to outing kids online because I feel like there's all this bad behavior that happens, but it's a part of growing up, twisted as it may be, and it can just tar and feather kids in a way that stays with them and can really, like, wreck their lives. So usually it makes me really nervous, but these kids, it's so direct and targeted, the bullying and harassment, and no one's doing anything else about it. And you feel like, why should it be part of adolescent culture to have it be in any stretch okay to tell a girl to kill herself? That's such a sick thing to do that I found myself, you know, feeling like I was glad that Anonymous stepped in here. And it's a kind of internet policing that I haven't seen thus far. So I'm also just struck by it.
Now, were the bullies actually doxxed? Do people now know who they are?
Yeah, pretty much.
So
yeah.
What did the apology get them?
Well, it got them Anonymous kind of leaving them alone. I'm not sure what actually played out in their real lives at their school. It seemed like in the Kylie situation, those kids knew each other. And in fact, one of the tweets in cruelly telling her to kill herself listed off the first names of 5 or 6 kids. So it wasn't even like it was really hidden. It was just that it hadn't surfaced and gotten attention from any adults. So I guess what the kids get in the end is just like being able to sort of crawl back into their holes. But I think what Anonymous is really hoping, because I was talking to one member who goes by the screen name Ash, who'd been really involved in this, they want these kids to really think about what they're doing. And in talking to Ash and a friend of his who was helping him, they have this very common sense idea that these kids aren't evil. They just need to like be kind of brought up short in terms of the harm they're causing. They need to be made to think about their actions. And none of the adults in their lives seem to really be keeping track of them online. So why should these other adults who were watching just like sit by for it?
I think that gets to the really key point here, which is, I think you point out in your article about this, that you basically don't have the luxury of having highly trained, digitally savvy adult enforcers there to stop every incident of vicious internet bullying. So what is it that happens when there aren't anonymice lurking over shoulders? How is it that kids themselves are going to stop this? What are the mechanisms by which this can be stopped without Anonymous?
Right. So what you want, obviously, is for other teenagers who know what's going on to rise up and say, hey, this isn't okay. And that does happen once in a while. But when you see people really ganging up on a social network site and you're another kid just like them, it's a lot to ask that you're going to take them on. I mean, this is true generally in the research about bullying. We are constantly exhorting children to be defenders instead of bystanders. But if you think about how any of us act in real life, when you see a conflict, it's hard to make yourself intervene. So
right, especially because the person and being bullied is almost certainly low status, low power, or
exactly.
more likely to be low status.
Well,
right.
That's a question I have. If they are low status, low power, which are the people doing the bullying of sufficient status that you could then, that one signature case here could be used to frighten them and basically say, you know, if your name gets out and gets associated with this, it's like what people say about, you know, pictures of you doing beer bongs on your Facebook page, that like you don't want to put that on your Facebook page because it will haunt you later in life. Or are the people making these horrible tweets, you know, just kind of have nothing to lose in life in general?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that we don't know the answer to that, but there's a second incident that Ash and his friend have gotten involved with where there were four boys who were just writing all kinds of trash to a girl who they knew was 12 years old. They were, like, threatening to gangbang her. It was really gross. And when Anonymous threatened to dox these boys and actually did, I think, basically do that, two of them became really remorseful and then, you know, started emailing back and forth with Ash and his friend about how maybe they should have some anti-bullying initiative at their school and help make that happen because there was nothing like that. And then the other two kids basically just, like, wanted nothing to do with it. So maybe the answer is that some of these kids can be reached and some of them can't, but at least there's someone out there trying.
John, do you think that bullies, internet bullies who are hiding behind anonymity, if they're children, that they should be outed to their schools and to their communities?
Yeah, I do, pretty much, particularly this behavior. Like, I have absolutely zero tolerance for it. I also have a sense of but proportion, though. I mean, we all did really stupid things. Suggesting a girl drink bleach, I have to remove my own incredibly emotional reaction to that. Which would be that these people should be punished within an inch of their lives, which is, I realize, absurd. But I mean, part of, if you believe that failing and then learning and adapting is a part of childhood and that we should give kids space to fail, you also need to make the failure real. Kids should be punished and outed for this, and then, you know, they learn something and they move on. But it needs to be real, the punishment.
Right.
And so all the stupid stuff I did, I had fortunately had parents who made me incredibly embarrassed, you know, in the version of going back to the store and returning the thing you shoplifted, but much worse. And that mattered. But there are lots of people who don't have parents like that. And nevertheless, they should, you know, there should be some system for helping them learn the lesson that this is horrible behavior. Because if you don't, it grows like a cancer.
Right. I totally agree with you, although I guess where I get confused, not worried, is this question of the eternity of the internet, which
right.
is that your name, it's one thing for your parents, you've shoplifted, John Dickerson, for your parents to make you go return the bubble yum to the shopkeeper. That's a private matter. The world doesn't know it. Your name is not recorded anywhere. It's another for it to be out there. Everyone in the community knows that you've done this and you've been shamed and it is on your permanent record because Google is a permanent kind of thing. And that is the part that has me baffled. Emily, I'm sure you've thought this out in a very sophisticated way.
That's kind of you. I think it's a real dilemma. You know, the Europeans are talking about the droit d'oublier, like the right to forget online, and the idea that kids in particular should be able to have some kind of eraser button. It's interesting, though, because I think part of what Anonymous, what Ash, when I was talking to him this week, was talking about is basically changing the norm. That so people, adults are often mystified that kids write such incredibly stupid stuff online, but the reason they do it is that nobody ever gets caught. Like, if 99.9% of the time all the garbage you write is just your garbage, why would you think you're going to be the one? And so part of what these doxing episodes do is that they create a different norm. They make kids kind of sit up straight. The problem with that, of course, is it's about making an example of a few kids to kind of scare the other kids straight. And that's like those kids are kind of getting sacrificed in the meantime. And then I think you're right, John. We have to have some idea of proportionality and then some tolerance for youthful indiscretion so that the punishment is intense in the moment but doesn't last forever.
All right. That's it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Search for Slate Political Gabfest in iTunes. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The next voice you'll hear will be Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. On today's program, the Lifetime movie Liz and Dick, which is, of course, about Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor and their romance, and then the phenomenon known as Supercuts with Slate's own Seth Stevenson, and finally, Snapchat, an app that may or may not enable teen sexting. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, our film critic, Dana Stevens.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Dana. Dana, I'm going to start with you because this seems totally...
Because I'm the movie chick, right?
And you're the movie chick. This is in your power alley. So Liz and Dick is a Lifetime movie. It chronicles the stormy, one could even say, my impression by the end of the film was totally bipolar relationship between Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. It stars Lindsay Lohan as Taylor and Grant Bowler. I'm totally unfamiliar with him as Richard Burton. Before we get further into our discussion about this movie, I bet we should give our listeners a taste of its preposterousness. Let's listen to a clip from Liz and Dick.
So now you're a method actor?
No. But now I have to act that I am in love with you and that you are in love with me, and that's not easy. Help me. Please. That I could love you, an exquisite queen. Simple. But that you could love me, a jobbing soldier.
Are you staring at my chest?
Why not? It's the very heart of you. It's everything you promise, love, sex, and nurture. And I'm going to pretend that it's all mine.
It's gotten a lot of press, much of it of the kind of howling incredulity variety. What did you make of it?
Well, I mean, essentially, this movie is a stunt, right? This movie exists so that Lindsay Lohan can play Elizabeth Taylor. And the marketing of it was essentially that. It was the slow unveiling of what is she going to look like as Elizabeth Taylor. And I think that the absurdity of casting Lindsay Lohan as Elizabeth Taylor was fully implicit in this whole marketing campaign. I think it's, you know, part of it is let's all gawk at the spectacle of Lindsay Lohan, the self-destructing starlet. And I really honestly think that a huge part of it also was this kind of so bad it's good. It was almost aiming for a campy so bad it's good audience from the beginning. Wouldn't you guys agree?
I couldn't tell what the intentionality was behind the movie. It certainly got, I mean, I read an interview with the network or the producers saying that they were striving to create a major television event, and it certainly felt like a major television event. It seemed like everyone I follow on social media was watching it and tweeting about it and raising their eyes and hands to the heavens in shock and horror at the ghoulishness of this movie that they were all lapping up like cats with milk. So I don't know. I couldn't tell how much they were intending it to be a serious film and how much they wanted it to just be goofy.
I know. Well, it's hard to say. Yeah, I agree that reading the intentionality is hard. I'll tell you what the effect is, though. A movie in which any or every part could have been played by Martin Short is not regardable as a success. I mean, it instantly entered the realm of self-parody and never exited it. It felt as though the movie were a strung together series of usable cuts, right? Dana, Lindsay Lohan has a very high profile substance abuse problems. She's been effectively unhirable because of this. I was shocked to discover this is her first movie in 5 years and she's so young. So you understand there might be an original uncynical analogy that motivates the casting of Lindsay Lohan as Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor makes National Velvet when she's 12. Lindsay Lohan makes, help me out, Parent Trap, maybe when she's
Freaky
12, effectively becomes a movie star when she's 12. And now is whatever else her virtues and demerits as a human being or an actress are. I mean, she's paparazzi bait to the maximum degree the way Liz Taylor was.
And I actually think she understands that. I didn't think she was so bad as Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, the dialogue is so bad. The movie is so incredibly terrible. The pacing, the dialogue, just the simple storytelling and understanding what's going on. I mean, if you hadn't read Furious Love, which I think this book is largely based on, which I've endorsed on the Gabfest, this fabulous history, sort of scholarly history of the Burton-Taylor romance, I don't think you'd have any idea what was going on.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, but what's the origin of that, Julia? Or should we even bother speculating? It felt to me as though she were being dragged across the finish line by everyone else around her. Maybe that's a totally subjective impression. I mean, it was so badly written and so badly directed. Who knows? How can you pinpoint what created it as the botched exercise that it was? But what do you think?
Well, I have to say, I'm a fan of Lindsay Lohan's acting abilities. I think she was a really promising actress, and it makes me sad to see what strange things she seems to have done with her face, because I feel like if you're an actor, your face is your implement, and she's marred it, which weirdly works well. She seems to have had some plastic surgery procedures of the sort that women who are much older than she is have, so her face looks weirdly old, and then she seemed able to play Elizabeth Taylor in her 40s, and eventually her 60s or 70s, or I'm not even quite sure
how
old she
is. I mean, she understands something about Elizabeth Taylor. She understands what it is to be a depressed, drunk movie star hounded by the paparazzi, at the very least. And I think in some of those scenes, those down-and-out scenes, she had plenty of vitality. I think she was perfectly fine. The fact is that she just doesn't have anywhere near the kind of charismatic luster that Burton and Taylor did. I mean, granted, it's going to be hard to find movie stars that do, but these two actors lack it to an almost risible extent.
But I mean, also the parallel breaks down, right? I mean, Elizabeth Taylor, we now retrospectively know via ample evidence that she had some of these tendencies towards, hysteria in her private life, extremely volatile. Would she show up on set? How would she perform? Nonetheless, she turned in, iconic Hollywood performance after iconic Hollywood performance. I mean, the one mildly interesting plot development in the course of the movie is that she keeps winning Oscars and he keeps not winning them, and what that does to his, apparently quite fragile ego on that score. She was a remarkable screen presence, and I mean, it's such a kiss of death to put someone like Lindsay Lohan, whose public life is the inability to hold it together, right? Who's that's upfront about her. And relative to that, there have been two or three fetching but relatively minor screen performances. I thought this was a kind of gross, kind of a sick ratings joke played on this poor young actress who needs to get her life together somehow.
I agree, but I don't think it was her that brought the movie down. I agree that there's something exploitive and gimmicky about the existence of the whole movie that makes me sad, but I don't think you can pin it on Lindsay Lohan's performance.
No, she seems game throughout. She seems like she's trying to make a go of it, and she sort of soldiers through. I mean, to me, part of the problem almost seems to be, I think one of the things that is amazing about Elizabeth Taylor and her performances is she marries this incredible earthiness with this goddess-like sense that she's been deposited from on high as the most beautiful face on the planet. I mean, she's like the only actress I can think of who could plausibly play Helen of Troy. And Lindsay Lohan has the earthiness and the paparazzi familiarity, but she does not have the kind of golden rays of sunlight streaming around her as she, and especially not now. So it does, I agree, it does seem unfair. But talk about the framing device, Tana.
Oh, yeah, just because I feel like that is one of the moments where it slides into camp and becomes something enjoyable. I mean, at least as a kind of object of mockery, it becomes somewhat enjoyable, which is that they pack all the exposition to this bizarre framing device where we see Liz and Dick in some kind of black, it looks like inside the actor's studio, right?
Inside the actor's studio or the mind of God, right?
Yeah, they're like, basically inside the actor's studio in the sky. I think they're both supposed to be dead at this point.
Yes.
They're all in black. They're in black director's chairs, and they're sitting and sort of reminiscing about their relationship, making sure that they pack in all the information about, we met in 1961 on the set of Cleopatra, cut to the set of Cleopatra. And it's such a poor storytelling choice. It almost makes you wish, as bad as this was, that it had been a miniseries or a two-parter so that it could have dug in and told their story.
For more Liz and Dick.
Well, there is going to be Martin Scorsese's making a film about Liz and Dick, and it is definitely based on the book Furious Love, and it did make me excited for that because there were so many great opportunities for drama in the real life story that were thrown away. Mm. For example, Cleopatra, where they meet and where the movie begins, was the most over budget movie in history at its time. The director, Joe Mankiewicz, was on uppers and was on this crazy, grandiose, manic dream where he kept borrowing more and more money to make this impossible movie. I mean, there were so many great background stories.
So you are holding out for Elizabeth and Richard from Martin Scorsese, and you want it to be an epic / miniseries?
Starring Martin Short and Martin Short. That movie, once again, is Liz and Dick. It's on the Lifetime Network. Check your local listings. Coming up, Snapchat, Harmless Diversion or Den of Iniquity. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. The term supercut was coined in 2008 by the blogger Andy Bayo. Joining us to talk about this phenomenon is Slate's own Seth Stevenson. Hey, Seth.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. Why don't you tell us exactly what a supercut is and how you came across them and what you've made of them in your piece?
Well, the classic supercut is when someone takes one word or phrase from a TV show or such and edits it together in a rapid-fire montage. So the classic example is this: every time someone says what on Lost, or there's more recently, every time someone takes a drink on Mad Men. Sometimes they can be a sort of a more of a video essay, like exposing a trope, within movies. So, for instance, very often when there's about to be a battle, people will say, "We've got company," or something like that, or people looking at computer monitors and investigating a crime will say enhance, and so you'll see supercut of every time that happens. So that the classic ones are the ones that just repeat these things or expose these tropes. Sometimes they can be slightly more sophisticated video essays.
What killed me about the Lost one is I'm unfamiliar with. I never watched the show Lost either, but clearly what makes that so compelling is that gets at the essence, right? Some hidden or half hidden essence of the show, and something about the show that's kind of ridiculous that everyone's subconsciously noticed, and it's brought just so economically to the surface by cutting together all of the, you know, this one tick basically that the show repeatedly exhibits.
Right. So I talked to the guy who made that supercut, and he was a videographer at a public library, and his girlfriend really liked Lost, and he just didn't like it, or his coworkers really liked Lost, and he just didn't like it at all, and he wanted to expose the fact that there are these repeated instances of a character saying what as an excuse for other characters to recap these expository points, and he kept threatening to make this video to his coworkers to expose this flaw he saw in the show, and they dared him to do it. Finally, they actually bought him the DVD set, and he did it. And it didn't take him very long. He was an experienced editor, and he did it pretty quickly. And there it was. And he just put it up for his friends. But when he came back from a weekend, he found it had 50,000 views on YouTube. To his amazement, he'd sent it to like something like 10 friends, and it just kept spreading and spreading and spreading. And people just loved to see this. And whether they were fans of Lost who just liked, I guess, seeing lots of characters saying what on Lost, or whether they had the same problems with the show that he had, people couldn't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, why don't we listen to a different one? Julia, which one are we going to check out?
Let's listen to I'm Not Here to Make Friends.
I didn't come here to make friends. I'm not here to make friends.
I'm not here to make friends.
I'm not here to make friends.
I ain't here to make no friends.
I'm not here to make friends.
I'm not here to make friends.
I'm not here to make friends.
You know, I'm not here to make friends.
You guys are not my friends. I'm not here to make friends with you.
I didn't come all the way from D.C. to make new friends.
I love that one because I think when it first went around, it did. You had that flash of insight that you sometimes have, I think, when you're reading a really great novelist and they observe something about the nature of being alive that you have noticed without noticing out loud to yourself. You know that moment you have sometimes when you're reading fiction and somebody captures something about the way the light hits a river under trees from a plane, and you're like, I've seen that. That's right. That's a thing that happens.
Right. Or even better, about human nature, right? And you've just encountered it over and over and over again in the people
without,
that you know.
Without ever putting right. a name to it. And it's a lofty comparison, but I think there is something when a supercut is really brilliant and really nails something that is an underlying cliche that has not yet been exposed, it does it so ruthlessly and, as you say, so economically, Steve, although that clip does go on for a few more tens of seconds after we dialed it down, I think. And you realize that these people on these reality shows are A, not there to make friends, B, that they're all kind of imitating this personality of the reality show contestant. Like, they've all learned how to be reality show contestants from watching other reality shows. The whole nature of it, and then the forcedness and falseness of their interactions comes into play. I think it's possible to make quite sophisticated points with this tool. It's also possible to make really bad, boring, stupidly edited supercuts, or to make supercuts that are really just fan worship, or, you know, it's not a universal force for good, but it can be kind of a brilliant one. So you, as part of your research for this piece, tried to make a supercut. What was that like?
I made one of those bad, boring supercuts that did not illuminate anything. It was an interesting process. So I picked a supercut realm that would be pretty easy for me to do. I picked I used the first season of New Girl, the Zooey Deschanel sitcom, and I looked for every instance in which her pink cell phone case with bunny ears appeared, every frame that it appeared in the show. And the reason I picked it was it seemed sort of bounded. It's only 23, 30-minute episodes, and it's a visual thing I'm looking for, so I didn't have to listen to the dialogue. I could fast-forward through and just look for the appearance of that pink cell phone case, which is pretty easy to spot. So I knew it would be quicker. I wouldn't have to spend months putting this together, like the people who put together a cut like that. I'm not here to make friends. Anyway, the cut that I made of this New Girl cut, the interesting thing to me was how obsessive I got, how quickly I sunk into the editing process and enjoyed it and lost track of time, and 3 hours went by without me even realizing it. I just was looking for this cell phone case, and I looked up and 3 hours had gone by, and I hadn't even, it was kind of fun. It was a little puzzle. It was a little hunt, and I enjoyed the process. I got into it.
But did it send a Tolstoyan shaft of light to the heart of human experience, Seth?
Steve, that's an interesting I don't know how to respond to that. I would say the thing that I realized, the thing that I liked about it was I felt I was seizing control over the media. I felt like here's this thing that's the sitcom that's been put on a plate for us and handed down to us. And for decades, we've just accepted these sitcoms and they've been beamed into our lives. And suddenly I had control over it. I could reshape it. I could do whatever I wanted to it. And that it's that feeling of power that I think is the thing that drives a lot of these supercutters.
Mm. What do you think is next for the supercut? Like, do you think the supercut is a critical form? Is still growing? Do you think we're kind of over supercuts? Like, do you ever have the experience where someone sends around a supercut and you're like, I really need to see another? Like, I know everybody drinks on Mad Men. Do I need to see everybody drinking on Mad Men?
Yeah, I think the supercut that's giving you hard evidence of some trope that you had expected, that you had suspected existed but weren't quite sure, such as the I'm not here to make friends one. I mean, you sort of felt like that was something people said you weren't sure, and oh, here's the hard evidence. They really do say that all the time. It's funny. But at this point, we've seen enough supercuts exposing those tropes that maybe we can just stipulate TV shows, movies have a lot of tropes that they repeat, and maybe we don't need to have hard evidence so that we can just all agree that that happens. I'm kind of bored of seeing that. There was one recently that showed Bruce Willis breaking lots of stuff. I think we all knew Bruce Willis breaks lots of stuff. Do we really need hard evidence of that? Do we really need to spend 3 minutes watching a supercut of that? I think there's room, though, for people to do more interesting things. I think, you know, look at Christian Marclay's The Clock, which is probably the most artistic supercut ever made. I think that's doing something interesting. He's doing something more artful with it, and the fact that it links to the world around, the fact that the time shown in maybe, I mean, Julia, I know you're a big fan of The Clock. Maybe you should.
Yeah, well, we did it on a rhapsodic segment on the show, which may or may not have been comprehensible to people who haven't seen it. But basically, it's a 24-hour long film composed of clips from throughout movie history, including probably both Lindsay Lohan and Elizabeth Taylor, which in every single scene you see an image of a clock or a watch or a timepiece, or you hear someone talking about the time, and the film is only ever exhibited synced up to the time outside, so that when someone's saying it's 6:23 on screen, it is actually 6:23 wherever you are in the world. And I think you're right, Seth, there's something about that connection to yourself and your own experience of space and time that gives it a bit more depth than Bruce Willis breaking stuff. I think it has a bit more depth, Dana.
Well, it's also edited in an extremely sophisticated way, just in terms of the sight lines and kind of making it look as if the different shots connect to each other in some way. So that in addition to kind of accompanying these clips, you have this feeling that you're entering into some strange day, some giant impossible day in which all these things are happening at once. And I love that narrative element about it. And I think there are some YouTube supercuts online that also will make that attempt to sort of create their own coherent narrative within these borrowed clips. And I love that.
Yeah, I think this is the early stages of the video extension of what happened with audio in the 70s and 80s, where people were taking turntables and cutting things together, and DJs were making new things out of old music. And you have an album like Paul's Boutique, for example, that's just all samples, making something new out of a lot of different old things. And I think we're in the early stages of people doing that with video, and it'll get more and more sophisticated and better and better.
Right. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Seth, for coming in and guiding us through this. Before we did the segment, I actually thought it was going to be about cheap mall haircuts, but
thanks.
Well, Seth Stevenson's piece is on Slate, and it's called The Secret Lives of Supercutters. It's terrific. Check it out. All right. Well, the web unfolds, as Julia Turner is always telling me, at the crossroads of ephemerality and permanence. That's the weird thing about the web, right? It feels as though what you do on there doesn't count, and yet it's the one place where it probably lasts forever and ever and ever. For those tempted to do something stupid on the internet, there's now an app for you. It's called Snapchat. Julia, once again, Grandpa needs this explained to him extra slowly, but apparently there are people who send each other salacious texts over the internet.
Steve, your feigned ignorance of Snapchat isn't fooling me. So Snapchat is a wildly popular photo app. I think it's even more popular than Instagram, which is the other photo sharing app we've talked about on the show, at least on some mobile platforms. And what it does, as I understand it, is it allows you to send a picture to your friend or friends and to set a time within which that picture will self-destruct on their phone. So they will receive your message, they can hold down your message, and they'll see the image for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 seconds, and then it disappears and they can no longer see the image. So you could use this to send photographs of your genitalia to your loved ones, or you could use this to send, you know, yourself making a goofy face, or you could use it for all other sorts of purposes. I downloaded the app this morning to try it out and found that almost no one I know uses it except for Jacob Weisberg, our esteemed leader. I assume this is because of his lovely young children who may perhaps use it as well. Steve, you downloaded the app, and I sent you a Snapchat photo of the cover of Fox in Socks by Dr. Seuss, obviously, your alter ego. And you looked at it. I think we're both slightly mystified by the app. I think I'm with you, Grandpa. I mean, I think the larger mystery of this is a lot of teens are using it. It's wildly popular. To what degree are they using it to sext, and to what degree are they using it to just goof around?
Mm-hmm. The founder of Snapchat has pleaded kind of naivete about its uses, and says, "Oh, I suppose the right things," when confronted with what it's probably being used for. Do you think it's innocent or not so innocent?
One interesting write-up that I saw compared the existence of this app to a head shop, right? A place where you go and buy drug paraphernalia, but there's this sort of hush-hush about what you're going to use it for, and this kind of wink-wink presupposition, like, yeah, you're going to use that skull bong to smoke some apple tobacco. And it seems to me like Snapchat functions on that same kind of logic. If you look at their page, there actually is a warning. It's for 12+, right? There's a parental warning on the cover page in iTunes, and it says something like, may be used for mildly salacious content. There's this kind of category of mild salaciousness for people older than 12. So it seems to me, I was trying to imagine, if my daughter were that old and she wanted to download this app, I mean, for one thing, I probably would not be able to stop her. She could just do it in secret. But what would I think about it? Would I try to stop her usage of it? I mean, I guess I can see how it sort of limits the damage that can come from the teenage desire to do things that aren't smart. It, as every write-up has pointed out, is in no way foolproof. You can take a screenshot of the picture before it self-destructs on your phone, although the other user will then be notified that you've taken a screenshot, but there's still not anything they can do about it. Or there's no way that this could be detected. You could just simply take a picture of your phone with a different device. It's hard for me to see, again, the head shop analogy, it's hard for me to see exactly what the utility of this would be if it wasn't dirty pictures. If you're taking a picture of your Thanksgiving turkey to send grandma, why do you need it to self-destruct after 10 seconds?
I think there is a use that I've heard about both from teens, and I actually posted the question on our Facebook page to see if any listeners use the app, and a couple of them said that they do this. So, for example, one listener on our page said, my best friend and I send each other ridiculous pictures of our faces during the day with the express purpose of making each other laugh. We also use the pen tool and the caption tool to write ridiculous short phrases about our day or to highlight particularly grotesque contortions of our faces. So that's like a fairly innocuous use. So there certainly are innocuous uses, and I sort of suspect, with any gimmick that teens are playing with, there's probably a range of uses, and the sort of more adventuresome troublemaking kids are sending each other junk shots, and the rest of them are kind of testing out slightly safer uses and experiencing the thrill of a tool that could be dangerous, mm-hmm. or could be on the borderline of what they're allowed to do.
Yeah. Well, Dana, this raises an interesting point, right? I was also struck by the head shop analogy. But maybe there's another analogy, right? Kids are just by definition, they're reactive, they're immature, they're impulsive, and they have no sense of who they're going to be in 6 months, much less 5 years or 10 years. They don't understand that one day they're going to be creatures of regret, potentially creatures of regret. And I wonder if this isn't almost more like a condom campaign, right, where we just have to accept as a baseline assumption that kids are going to have sex. And if that's the case, I mean, in a perfect world, maybe they wouldn't, right? But we don't live in a perfect world. Therefore, we're going to introduce them to something that protects them from pregnancy and STDs. Why not say to kids who have no idea the degree of permanence that the internet holds for them, right? I mean, even these horrible kids who Emily Bazelon of Slate wrote a terrific piece. I think she was genuinely conflicted about this issue, about racist kids kind of being outed on the internet for things that they put on the internet in the first place, but mostly only for their own friends, being made vastly more public because they're truly loathsome in the hopes that maybe they'll, that they'll be shamed into a change of heart. Or whatever, whether that's an appropriate thing to do with a kid who really is not a fully autonomous moral actor. Similarly, kids are going to send all kinds of crazy to one another over the internet. Isn't it better if it vaporizes after 10 seconds rather than is a can tied around their tail for the next, God knows, 30 years of their lives?
Yeah, that's why I said I think it's a damage-limiting tool that I suppose could have some utility given that these photos will be out there and being sent anyway. But I'm not sure that I love the mealy-mouthed words of the CEO of Snapchat about, shocked, absolutely shocked that his app would ever be used for such a thing. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I sort of feel like if insofar as it's analogous to a condom, better to have it than not.
And one other thing that Snapchat protects you from, which a condom does not, is your parents, right? Like, if a parental way of monitoring their teen activity is, sure, you can have a cell phone, but I get to look at it every so often, or I get to kind of monitor what's coming in and out and make sure you're not doing anything too devious. I don't know. Is the parent going to know what the Snapchat app is and know to look at it? And even if you do look at it, all you can see is that your kid's been sending and receiving Snapchats, so you can't see the content of those images.
All right. Well, the app is Snapchat. Download it if you want to see Danny Stevens' junk. What? That's not appropriate.
Yeah, Steve, the junk in my desk drawer.
All right. Well, now it's time to endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Well, I'm going to endorse a new feature on Slate, which I'm really excited about. It's a photo blog called The Vault, and it's basically a historical photo blog. So Rebecca Onion, who's the historian who created this feature, just chooses an image from history. The last one she posted was Grace Coolidge, the wife of Calvin Coolidge, had a pet raccoon in the White House. And there's a wonderful black and white picture of Grace Coolidge cuddling with her pet raccoon. And she writes a little bit about that. But essentially, it's an image a day. Is it every weekday, Julia, it's going to go up?
Yep.
With a little bit of a historical caption. And it's always just a really grabby image and something about history that you never knew, like Grace Coolidge's raccoon. So check out The Vault next time you go to Slate.
Okay. Julia, what do you got?
I'm sorry, guys. I'm about to ruin all of your lives, or at least those of you who are susceptible to iPhone games. If you are prepared to waste hours and hours, download a game called Flow. I think you have to search for Flow Free to get the free version. It is a game so inane that I can't really try and describe it without sounding like a crazy person, but basically you're trying to connect dots by colored lines without crossing the lines and filling up all the squares in the grid in grids of various size. But I promise you, it's really addictive and fun.
All right. Well, I'm going to bring you back to terrestrial sounds. This is the weirdest endorsement of my entire life. So it turns out that if you go see baby lammies, you can, and these were all of 6 hours old, you can get them to baa at you in unison if you encourage them just so. It's the most amazing thing you've ever heard. My actual endorsement is one of my favorite poems, which occurred to me when I went and looked at these lammies. It's called First Sight by Philip Larkin, which is about baby lambs being born in winter. We'll put it on the website too. Ha ha, joke's on you. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephen.
Julia, as always.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Vuolo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week.